Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at pem.org. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The headline writers loved it. Hotel and a real estate heiress Leona Helmsley left a relative pittance to her family and billions to the dogs. $12 million for her Maltese named Trouble, maybe $8 billion for the dogs of New York. Many people have wonderful, close relationships with their pets. Many give money to animal causes. And then there are those whose relationships with their pets are, let's say, a little deeper. Joining me first today from New York is Stephanie Strom, who's been following the Leona Helmsley dog bequest story for the New York Times. Stephanie, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're pretty good. So give us the breakdown here. I mean, it may not be $8 billion, and it may not even be $12 million for poor little Maltese Trouble. But what were the numbers, and what's the backstory here?
Well, Leona's will left Trouble $12 million, and the probate judge decided that that was a little bit rich and lowered that amount to $2 million.
A judge can just do that when it's in the will, come in and say, it's only a dog, so...
Apparently so. No one has challenged it yet. I think as long as all the family members agree, and Trouble can't speak for herself, so she
I'm sure the family members won't mind. What? Who was the family? What did they get, Stephanie?
The family. Her brother received. It's slipping my mind the exact amount, but her brother received, I believe, $10 million. So the income off $10 million.
Not too bad.
Two of her grandchildren received the income off $5 million apiece, as long as they promised to visit their father's grave once a year, and they have to sign a book attesting to that.
Okay.
There were two other grandchildren that were left out of the will. The judge reinstated them to the tune of about $6 million in total.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but none of them anywhere near the $12 million that she laid out for Trouble or the potentially $8 billion for the dogs of New York. Now, that wasn't in the will, but that's in a separate bequest?
That provision was in a two-page document that very, very few people have seen labeled the mission statement.
Mm-hmm.
When Mrs. Helmsley originally had it written, she signed it. In 2003, it had three provisions. One, that her money should go for the care and support of indigent people. Two, that it should go for the care and support of dogs. And three, that it should be whatever else is left over should be used for at the discretion of her trustees. For reasons that no one that I've talked to yet knows, in 2004 she struck the first provision, namely that her money should be used for the care and support of indigent people.
So never mind poor people, that's out, but the dogs stayed in.
That's correct.
And
although, you know, several of our readers have suggested clever ways where you could benefit both people and dogs. For instance, you could give money to an organization that trains dogs to help blind people. There are many organizations now also training dogs to help veterans coming back from the war in various ways.
So people trying to get humans in there, but Leona Helmsley herself clearly in this, putting the dogs first, and it's 2-point-something billion in liquid assets, cash basically, and then another 3 to 6 billion in real estate holdings depending on what they're worth. Who does this go to, and has New York begun to think through what they could or would do with $8 billion for dogs? What could they possibly do with all that?
It's not just limited to New York dogs. It could be dogs in Poughkeepsie. It could be dogs in L.A. Essentially what happens is her trust becomes effectively a private foundation. The trustees are also the five executors of her estate, and they will decide how the money gets doled out. As a foundation, the money has to be, they are bound by federal law to spend at least 5% of the assets every year. Now, of course, the assets keep compounding if they're invested well. So, you know, the overall size could grow in time if the investment pattern is
right, if it's more than 5%. Have you seen proposals as to what they might do with all that money or that annual chunk of it?
Well, as I said, there have been, ever since the story ran, there have been a variety of people with a variety of creative ways of using this. You know, you could envision a university that does a lot of animal research. If there's a researcher there doing particular study on a particular type of canine cancer, the trustees could elect to use it that way. They could elect to use it for any one of the many number of dog rescue organizations.
Right.
Some of them are breed related, some not. And you know, there is the third provision still remains, that the trustees have some discretion over what they do with the money. And I suspect, although no one has told me this, that they will spend a certain percentage on canines. And the rest they'll use in other ways.
You know, the London Times was paying attention to this. They said, you know, $8 billion for dogs, it's the meek who are supposed to inherit the earth, not the mutts. And, of course, Leona Helmsley with her famously went to jail on tax charges, said only the little people pay taxes. Suzanne Pleshette played her in the film, and she was called the Queen of Mean. If there were such a thing, if people who knew her well spoken out about to interpret this, you know, her bequest and why she may have done it this way?
Well, people, not very many people knew her well, I would say. And the closest, the people who were closest to her are her trustees, her brother, her longtime lawyer, and an old friend who was smart in the real estate business. They knew her best. They're her trustees and they aren't talking. So we really don't know, in a way, exactly what she was thinking about what she wanted.
Meanwhile, her millionaire dog, the Maltese Trouble, you report, after this news came out, had death threats against it and now has security, I don't know, like bodyguards or something, that costs $100,000 a year.
That's right. It costs more than it costs to feed the dog each year to keep it safe.
Well, we'll be looking for those gold-plated, dog food bowls on the streets of Manhattan. Stephanie, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Stephanie Strom with the New York Times. Joining me now from New York is Joel Gabriel Gold, a psychologist who's been practicing in New York for more than 25 years. He's author of When Pets Come Between Partners. Dr. Gold, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
You've talked with lots of people about their pets and talked with patients via pets, and you know a lot about cats and dogs and people. What do you make of the Leona Helmsley story?
I find it fascinating. I think Leona, I don't know very much about Leona except what I've read in the papers, but I think either Leona must have suffered some kind of terrible injury in early in her life that affected how she regards the world. And I know from what I've read in the papers that she had lost her son, and that was a terrible blow to her, and that may have really impacted on how she sees the world and started to lead more towards dogs than people.
How common is this? How often do you see people whose relationship with their cat or dog or pet appears to be potentially more important than any relationship they have with a human?
Well, I see it with some frequency. Most of the people that I know and work with who have pets seem to have a very nice relationship within a very normal range.
Yeah.
There are some people who I think have a much more powerful and emotionally intimate relationship with their pet, primarily because I think where there's been situations of early abuse, physical abuse or sexual abuse, I think that can contribute to a tremendous distrust of the world and connecting with people. I think people who've come from families in which there were emotional issues that kept them from receiving the kind of parenting that helps healthy maturation, that may be the only ongoing, consistent reinforcement toward a sense of self came from a relationship with a pet. So I think that's not that unusual.
So as a psychologist, if the pet is the one who steps in to, in effect, become their support, do you see that, if they need it, as a healthy thing or as a kind of diversion from working their way back to good relationships with humans, other people?
Oh, I do think it's a healthy thing. I think that it can very much be a step along the way. Some people stay in that step and don't move on to the next step. I've always had dogs in my office. They're my co-therapists in a way.
You mean actually sitting there when you've done therapy for kids and others?
Yes, yes. And I originally had dogs in the office because I had found a dog that was freezing and starving many, many years ago and took it home, and the vet said the only way it was going to survive was to be medicated hourly, and the only way I could do that was to take the dog to the office. And I saw real transformations. I did a lot of play therapy with kids at the time, mm-hmm. as well as seeing adults, and I just saw kids who otherwise didn't trust adults at all start to have a relationship with the dogs. There was one little boy, his mother really wanted him to be the identified patient, and he wound up having a connection with a dog in the office.
Dr. Amos, Gold, hold that thought. We've got to take a short break here. We want to hear the story. Joel Gabriel Gold in New York. Stand by. We're talking about people and their pets. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about people and their pets, Leona Helmsley's maybe $8 billion bequest to the dogs of New York and beyond, and what's behind the extremes of human attachment to pets. Let's listen for just a moment here to a bit from the 2000 film Best in Show, Meg and Hamilton Swan, played by Michael Hitchcock and Parker Posey, feeling the pressure of an upcoming dog show. Here they're prepping with their Weimaraner, Beatrice.
In front of me, you see a big blue ribbon. It's right here in front of you. You want it? You come and you grab it. You get it.
She's not listening to you. She's nervous. She's freaking out.
Well, get the busy bee. You want your busy bee? You get your busy bee.
You get the busy bee. I need to trim her whiskers. It's in the crate.
Where is it?
It's in the crate.
Why didn't you have it out to begin with? Where are the crate? It's not in here. It's not in here.
It should be in the crate.
It's not in the crate. I just told you that.
God, Hamilton, if she doesn't get her door, she's going to flip out.
She needs her busy bee in Best in Show there. Maybe they're a little too bound up in this. Joel Gabriel Gold joins us from New York. Psychologist, psychoanalyst, has been practicing in New York for more than 25 years, author of When Pets Come Between Partners. And Dr. Gold, you were saying, I mean, right there we see how people can get a little too wound up about anything, including maybe their dog. But you've said you've seen it in your practice, how good this can be.
Absolutely. I was starting to say, I love that movie, by the way.
Me too.
One of the little boys I worked with, his mother was a single parent, and she clearly made the little boy her identified patient instead of getting help herself. And she said he was slow and he was overweight and he never did anything. Well, he walked in and took one look at this Labrador Retriever and just fell in love with the dog. And I didn't even exist, and he developed this relationship with the dog, and one day after about 2 months of just being with the dog and me sitting back and being quiet, he said in the lowest whisper, "I wish you were my mother." And that relationship just developed, and as a result, he started doing better in school. He lost weight. When I first met him, he had the saddest eyes I've ever seen on a little kid. Mm. He started to look bright and alert. His mother couldn't tolerate it. And she came in one day and she said, "He doesn't need psychotherapy. He's been diagnosed as epileptic. All he needs is medication." Mm. And she took him out of treatment. And I have to tell you, it was one of the saddest days of my life. But I know that somewhere that young man is walking around with the memory of this dog in his heart.
And it might have worked for him. Of course, now there's a whole story of medication for dogs and pets themselves, and we'll hear about that. And we've got the Leona Helmsley money sitting right in front of us, and a lot of people who with something to say about that. Let's go to Carl in Norwood, New York. Carl, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I got on early because I take the broad view of Leona Helmsley's bequest, and whether I agree with it is moot. I understand it if I wouldn't care to copy it. Namely, it's an opinion of our national state of ethics, wherein, since dogs do much more good than harm in this world, as animals do in general, compared to the two-legged animals, us, I think she was saying, people, we have so much between the ears, in the wallet, and look at what we do. And in this election year, the very issue in the 21st century of color, or the word different used pejoratively, or he's not like us. Dog looks at you, says, hi, hello, can I trust you? Will you be good to me? And that is all.
So the dog's maybe doing less harm than people with that straightforward approach. Carl, thanks for that. Let's get one from East Hampton, New York. Anna, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hello. I feel that what Leona Helmsley did, I totally understand, because she had a lot of money, and I'm sure she came upon a lot of people that, because of the money, some was nice to her and did stuff for her. However, with dogs, there's no interest behind it. They love you unconditionally, and they're always there for you. So I understand why she left all that money for dog research or for dog charities. And especially when people called her the Queen of Mean and all that.
People weren't nice to her. Maybe dogs were, and they weren't after her money, so they get it, and it sounds fine with you. Let's get one more. Thank you, Anna. Let's get one from Lawrence, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I thank you and the producer who took my call for having me on the air.
Sure.
Yeah, this is Johnny from Lawrence. I think that if Leona Helmsley was on her right mind, if she had a sound mind at the time she decided this is a crime. But if she had mentally incapacitated, then it's an ill will. What I think is that this should be a start from being executed either ways. There's too many people going hungry in the world. There's too many children crying at noon and in the afternoon, evening, and night because they haven't had anything to eat all day to be leaving millions and millions and millions of dollars for dogs. Now, remember, any Jewish or Christian or anybody who believes in creation, in the creation theory, knows that the animal were done for the men, not the men for the animals.
But pets, dogs bring a lot of pleasure to people. So, you know, and there's a lot of dogs out there. I suppose they have needs too. 8 billion's too much for dogs, Johnny?
Absolutely ridiculous, Tom. It is a crime against humanity to leave $8,000 million for dogs. It is totally a crime. This will should be stopped from being executed. This money should be going to veterans who are not receiving, you know, proper coverage, people who don't have health insurance, they have sickness problems, and children who are going hungry to bed every night.
Johnny, we've got it, and yet you see where she put it, and she had the choice of sending it, directing it anywhere she liked, and there's something in that relationship that got her attention. But you say it's a crime. Let's go to, I want to bring in right now a voice from Urbana, Illinois. Stephanie Lafarge is with us. She's a psychologist and senior director of counseling services for the ASPCA. Stephanie Lafarge, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Very glad to be here.
I mean, I want to look more closely at this relationship and, you know, where they're good and deep and enriching for dogs and people and where they maybe go too far. But what's your opinion first of Madam Helmsley and her $8 billion maybe to dogs?
I think we need to put this gift in the context of the very large, generous impulses that all Americans have. Approximately $250 billion is given every year. Only about 3 to 5% of that goes to nature-related, animal-related causes. So Americans are very, very generous in their charitable giving. The ASPCA is pleased to be part of that charitable giving in that when we follow our mission to help animals, especially companion animals, we know we are helping people, as you referred to. There are so many ways in which animals help people.
Do you see all kinds of instances of pet abuse and problems between pets and people? Do you see instances in which the relationship gets too close somehow, and that becomes a problem, Stephanie?
Yes. One of our former presidents, the late Roger Karras, made a wonderful point. He said, animals bring out the best and the worst in people. So you do have instances in which people are thought to, quote, love too much, and they hoard animals, and the animals are harmed. But you have so many examples of ways in which animals have been bred, companion animals. We human beings knew what we needed. We needed a creature in our lives that gives us, as they call it, unconditional love. I don't agree with unconditional love as a term, Joel. I know you and I probably agree on this, but...
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Why not? Why do you think that's not the right phrase?
Because I think that there's something in the animal nature that brings out the best in us, so that when our pets respond to us, it is partly because we are giving them the best in ourselves, and we can't always give that to our, you know, human companions. The goal is to have a wide range of relationships, you know, young people, old people, children, husbands, whatever, and animals. It is not either or.
You're so right. But I agree with you.
Once the animal is in our lives, as companion animals are, they're entirely dependent on mm-hmm. human beings, then we have an ethical and reasonable obligation to make them healthy, and that's to our benefit, too.
But Joel, your book is titled When Pets Come Between Partners. Presumably that's human partners. I mean, that starts to sound like problematic.
It wasn't my choice of a title to begin with, but what the book is about is all the ways that we think the pet's the problem, when really we have to take a good look at ourselves and see what our psychological issues are. If there's something that's putting us in bad relationships or keeping us from a relationship, the book is really about the fact that it's not about the pet, it's about what the human interactions are.
Is unconditional love the right phrase for what pets give if, in fact, they're bred to sit there panting and looking up at those big brown eyes? Does that qualify?
No, I don't think that's a pet's job, and I agree with Stephanie. I think if we're going to talk about unconditional love, which is not my favorite term either, we have to talk about what parents have to give infants. I think that's the only place in the mammalian world that we should be talking about unconditional love. It's unconditional love for an infant, those first 3 or 5 years of life that really need total love to make a child grow and develop well.
And is it people who may have had some trauma who you find go to the most extremes with their pets necessarily of closeness? Or what about people who just want something, some living creature to control, have power over?
Well, I think control is an issue. I think there are control freaks, and I think that I've worked in situations where people have been brutal in their control of animals, and I what worries me the most about that is, given the opportunity, they would pretty much operate the same way with people.
Let's take a call from Pawleys Island, South Carolina, and Kim. Hi, Kim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Your gentleman on the panel just really hit home with me, talking about past issues and, you know, losses and connecting to their animal. My husband and I tried to conceive for 5 years, and I have a chronic illness. We finally did conceive, and we miscarried.
Yeah.
And at that time, right afterwards, I picked up a cat from a kitten from the shelter. And come to find out and realized in looking back that he had been born on the day that our baby would have been born the next year. And he's 12 now. And needless to say, I have a very strong connection to him in that I'm sure that I transferred that loss into him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be really hard for me when he goes. I know he's just a cat, but to me, you know, it's a very strong connection that I have with him.
And it's been a support for you in the place of the child you weren't able to have, Kim.
Exactly, yes, and he's just so you know, loving to me. He couldn't care less about anyone else, but he's very loving to me. And I do realize that he is just a cat and that it is my transference of that loss. But it's still, it's going to hurt a lot when he does go.
So what do you think of Leona's move? I mean, after all, she did have grandchildren that she could have put in that spot just for starters.
No. Yeah, I think it was definitely out of proportion. Your family should come first, I think. And I think it's wonderful, for instance, if she had left a great amount of money to the ASPCA or Humane Society or both, a defined amount. I think it was very much out of proportion and not fair to her family.
Kim, thank you for your story, though, and we hear how important that cat, 12 years old now, is to you. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Cody, calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Cody, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I used to work in an animal hospital, and you'd see, especially with little dogs, you'd see probably about middle-aged women come in. They'd have no children and no families, and they'd treat the little dogs like babies. And I don't know about the health for them, but it seemed pretty unhealthy for the dogs.
Why?
Dogs are most happy when you treat them like dogs, and the dogs didn't know how to interact with other dogs. They didn't really know how to be dogs at all because they'd been treated like human children for so long.
Wow.
A lot of times they were also unhealthy because they were fed fattening stuff, the kind of stuff you'd give a kid, but you can't really give a dog.
Cody, thanks for calling. Stephanie, what about it? Is there a way in which, I mean, we hear from Kim how important it's been to her, and it sounds like it's worked for her cat as well, but can there be a way in which if people treat their animals too much like human companions, it becomes a negative for the pet?
Well, I wanted to comment that Kim's story is a very familiar one to me. Mm. I run a national pet loss hotline that answers calls from people all over the United States for a 24-hour basis who have either just lost their pet or anticipating losing their pet through euthanasia. And the sentence I hear the most is about 75% of the people actually say with some shame and embarrassment, "Oh, my God, I didn't cry this hard when my grandfather died or my best friend moved away. I'm shocked. I'm embarrassed. Do I love pets too much? Is there something wrong with me that I feel so bereft and so devastated?" And the answer is absolutely not, that we don't fully understand the nature of the attachment and the intimacy that we have with animals. It may be very hardwired. It may be quite different. It feels the same, and sometimes our culture says it's a substitute baby, and we dress up the animals. But the real bond probably exists deeply, deeply, deeply in our minds and brains and bodies, and the incorporation of an animal into your life is good for your immune system, it's good for your blood pressure, it's good for your cholesterol level. In every way, it benefits your health. So it's quite natural that people are drawn toward that.
Dr. Gold, pets is the fountain of youth, magic pill, I don't know, you name it. That's quite a list Stephanie rattles off there of potential benefits.
I agree with Stephanie on all of this. I find the same thing. First of all, I think that what Kim is reporting about the cat is wonderful that she could make that adjustment and that this cat is so valuable to her and there is such a wonderful relationship there. And I think that's perfectly fine. I think it's just great. Also, I have a number of people who come in because they wind up grieving their pet, the loss of the pet, more than they've grieved human losses, and I think that one of the main reasons for that psychologically is there's much less ambivalence in the relationship with the pet than there is in our human relationships. I think where there's been a lot of ambivalence in our human relationships, it makes it more difficult to grieve in a soothing way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about people and their pets. Leona Helmsley's maybe $8 billion bequest to the dogs of New York and beyond, and what's behind the extremes of human attachment. to pets. We've been joined from Urbana, Illinois by Stephanie Lafarge. She's a psychologist and senior director of counseling services for the ASPCA when people and their pets need help working it out. Joe Gabriel Gold joins us from New York, a psychologist and psychoanalyst, been practicing there for more than 25 years, author of When Pets Come Between Partners. And right now from Berkeley, California, we're joined by James Vlahos. His cover story in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine was titled Pill Popping Pets. He's a contributing writer for National Geographic Adventure and Popular Science. James, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
What's the news on the pets and pills front?
Well, the news is that there are a few new drugs coming to market that are for treating behavior and mood-related problems in pets. And probably the most talked about example is one called Reconcile. It's from Eli Lilly, and it's chemically identical to Prozac, or the generic drug fluoxetine. And this is being used to treat a problem called separation anxiety, which is when dogs are left at home alone, they get very anxious, chew up the carpet, chew up the door, eat things they shouldn't. And this drug, in combination with sort of behavior retraining, is used to stabilize their mood and hopefully get rid of the problem.
You write that the only difference between Prozac and Reconcile, this pet drug, is that Reconcile is chewable and tastes like beef. What's creating the need for this drug? Is it just that people want to treat their animals more like humans and humans are taking Prozac, or what's going on?
Well, this problem in particular, separation anxiety, is an interesting one, especially in the context of the discussion that you've been having here, because a lot of the cause of this problem seems to be, it's called separation anxiety, but really the problem is one of attachment, and specifically excessive attachment on the part of the pet toward their owner. So this can be a case where a dog that is treated so lovingly and is so doted on when the people are there, when the people leave for work at 8 in the morning and don't come back until 6, it is such a wrenching shock for the dog that it really goes mad in the house all by itself. So a lot of the treatment for that problem, in addition to the drug, deals with teaching the owners to sort of ease that attachment, and it's doing things like when you leave for work or come home from work, rather than making a great big fuss and petting the dog and giving it a treat right away, you actually ignore it completely for the first 15 minutes or so on either side, and that kind of makes the bond less intense, which I know is going to sound counterintuitive to a lot of people who are so doting to their pets, but it really does help with the problem.
Americans really into their dogs to the extent that we've now got a reality show based on this. CBS has one called Greatest American Dog. Here's a scene from that where Michael and his Boston Terrier, Ezzy, are the first contestants eliminated, and they're taking a kind of final lap. Listen for the love.
I hate leaving right now, but I am so proud of Ezzy. I can't even tell you. She is amazing.
We have a bond that very few have.
Our relationship is amazing.
You know, we'll keep dancing, kid. We'll keep dancing, so...
We have a bond that very few have. Stephanie Lafarge in Urbana, Illinois, what do you think of this new, here we have Prozac for dogs. What do you make of that? What does it say?
Well, I think the issues that are so well described in the article are true of all medications, psychiatric, psychotropic medications, where there is a tendency to substitute a quick fix into a situation that really could benefit from behavioral and management changes. Dogs are pack animals. They are evolved to live in packs. It is unnatural for them to be alone all day. And apartment living and some kinds of busy lives people have are also unnatural for people. It's one of the reasons that we so look forward to coming home to our animal and greet them so happily. I think that medications used as a platform to change the relationship in the direction of more exercise, in the direction of good training and so on, doesn't have to be a question of withdrawing the attachment per se, as a substituting what is more natural so the animal can relax when he's alone.
Joel, Dr. Gold, you're the psychologist here. What do you think of essentially Prozac being prescribed for dogs? What does that say to you about our relationship with our dogs?
I think that it's Well, I have some feelings about it, and I think there's a lot of humans on Prozac that probably could be doing other things rather than taking Prozac. But I think that as far as the issue of separation anxiety with dogs, I think that whenever a patient comes in with that issue, I would recommend getting a second dog. And most of the time, that really resolves the separation anxiety in the first dog, and everybody does just fine. So that's one of my non-Prozac recommendations.
Don't get a pill, get another dog. James Vlahos, you wrote the article. Did you come away convinced that this is really about just separation anxiety, or is that a marketing phrase, you know, that the pharmaceutical companies are putting on this? I mean, I think you've said that sometimes you've got what looks to you like human dysfunction rubbing off on dogs, separation or not.
Sure, and let me say first off that even this drug Reconcile, it's not being prescribed as a magic pill, being prescribed with the idea that it's done concurrently with the behavior modification. In fact, the terms of the approval from the FDA for the use of this drug are that it has to be used in conjunction with behavior modification. But I traveled around the country. I met a lot of what could only be described as seriously disturbed pets. So pets that chase their tail for hours and hours a day, a cat that stalked his owner and attacked him so violently that he was sent to the hospital, a dog that was afraid of fireworks. And the impression I got, both from firsthand experience and from talking to the professionals, was there's a certain fringe of these problems that are absolutely legitimate. Like, these are genuinely disturbed animals, and something's going on inside of their minds with their neurochemistry that goes beyond simply they have bad owners. I think that's the easiest answer. It's often the correct answer, but it's not always the correct one. Separation anxiety, that's kind of a sticky problem, because you do see so much what the owners are doing are going to affect the animal's mental health. And the only thing strange there is you have some dogs that are home alone all day in the apartment. They might be in a studio in Midtown, and they're fine, and another dog in a similar situation gets separation anxiety. So there is something going on besides simply that they have neglectful owners.
Do you think it's related to this humanizing of animals? We jumped off talking about Leona Helmsley and her bequest, but, you know, is there something in the extent to which people are, I don't know, I'm not sure if it's ignoring or dependent on their animals, or both here?
Yeah, it's very controversial, because we treat our animals like little people, and you see this in the products that people are increasingly buying for their animals. So the fact that they're sending them to spas where the dog is getting acupuncture and facial, and you wonder, is the dog really better off? Maybe he just wanted to chase a stick in a lake. So the danger is to assume on that sort of same type of thinking that, hey, this SSRI class drug makes me feel better. Maybe it's going to make my dog feel better as well. And I think to just make that assumption, prescribe the pill as the first choice, you could get into trouble. It seems better as a last resort when you've tried everything else and it doesn't seem to be working.
James Vlahos writing here about how American health problems are now look a lot like America's pets' health problems. Let's take a call from Ashby, Massachusetts. Krishnabai is calling. Krishnabai, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I think that people have a lot of love to give. And in these days of small families or no families, pets are a natural venue for that love. I'm a people therapist, and I wind up doing a lot of pet bereavement therapy when people lose their pets because they're embarrassed and they feel like they can't tell other people how deeply they've been moved. I have three dogs. They're all rescued, and they all work with me. And the one who was in the worst shape when he came to me instinctively will sit in people's laps and make sustained eye contact with clients. He'll lean up against their hearts if they're crying. He's amazing. And sometimes I'll just sit back and let him work. My dogs give physical contact to my clients that I can't. And they are priceless to me. And I think that they are not a subspecies. They are worthy of our love and attention and money.
So we've got a lot of love to give, and maybe not always these days enough human targets for it, you're seeing, Krishnabai.
Yeah, I think I see a lot of people who've had trauma in their life, and being around people is tough. Being around pets is easy.
Dr. Gold, that sounds like Krishna Bhai's dogs are filling the kind of role that yours may sometimes in the therapy room.
Exactly the same experience that she's having with her dogs I've had with my dogs, and I write about that very frequently because I just think it's such an incredible phenomena that dogs so instinctively know what people need and know how to give it. I've never trained any of my dogs. They've all passed on whatever they know about being in my consultation room to each other. They act quite differently outside the consultation room than they do when they're quote-unquote working. It's really quite amazing to watch them. They just really know what a person needs, and I'm always astonished.
Dog is therapist. Let's go to Mark in Concord, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I have a great story, but I want to preface my remarks by just saying I love animals, I grew up with animals, but I do think that some of these extreme measures that people take to anthropomorphize pets is a pathology and an indictment of American, not just American society, I guess more accurately, very wealthy societies where we kind of purchase our separation from our fellow human being and have hyper-control over these easily manipulated creatures. But I do love animals, and I just want to... But the story that I'm calling with is I've told many times and gets a bit
Let's hear
chuckle.
It. Let's hear it.
I'm a painting contractor in Concord, but years ago I worked on a construction crew in California, and there's a lot of different people on the crew. And from this one particular day, we showed up, and at about 7 in the morning, all day long, this neighboring dog just kept barking incessantly. So we noticed it, and people said, oh, we should call the Humane Society, we should call the police, but time passed, and you kind of forgot that the dog was barking, and it was just noise in the background. Mm. Well, about 2 in the afternoon, our supervisor, Steve, shows up, and he immediately notices the barking, and he suggested that, you know, once again, call the police or the Humane Society. And since all of us were gathered around, we were in close proximity to one another, and one of the men on our crew was from China, and his name was Tony, and Tony said, you know, in my country, those are the first dogs that we eat. So all of the workers started chuckling. That's kind of funny, but Steve was offended. Steve was a big animal lover, and he berated Tony and said, you know, Tony, in America, dogs are people's best friend. So Tony looked up without any irony at all and kind of confused look on his face and said, Americans, lonely people. So it kind of just speaks to how we must be perceived by people abroad who maybe have less income and less ability to afford this kind of...
And you saw it right there in the circle of construction workers in California. Mark, thanks for your call. Stephanie, what do you make of that? I mean, it cuts both ways here, and you hear both sides.
At the ASPCA, we run a program called Paws in Books. This is just to confirm the comments we've been making about the advantages to humans of animals in our lives. This is a program that takes children who have difficulty reading, presumably out of a kind of performance anxiety. You know, reading aloud is very, very nervous. And they read to the dogs. And lo and behold, there's an observable, significant change in their capacity to read better, perform better. We know people who stutter less. We know animals rehabilitate youth who appear to be sociopathic, make a bond, just as Joel had said, and return to what we like to think of as the best in human nature.
But what about our caller's story and his one-time colleague on the construction site there, Tony from China, you know, who looks at this and says, Americans, lonely people.
Well, if you look at 4-H clubs, children who are devoted to the heifers and pigs and so on that they raise, they know they're raising those animals for market. And they have a very, very intense bond with the animal. I think all over, in all cultures, people who work closely with animals, whether it's in their apartment or in their, for survival value in their culture, they may have very strong feelings. More and more neurology is telling us about things like mirror neurons. Our human tendency to look at something and identify with it and feel as if we can feel what that creature feels. These are not well understood yet, but it's coming that we will be able to explain the nature of the bond. What you choose to eat in a culture is very individual.
James Vlahos, what do you see coming here? You've looked out on the sort of frontier of pet pharmaceuticals. But, you know, with all the talk about animal rights and animal consciousness and its degree, I mean, do you think we're headed for a time here where more and more animals, pets, are sort of brought into that circle where they're seen as fuller and fuller, I don't know, mates in a way? I mean, you know, very tight companions in our society, our culture?
Well, I think we're getting to a point where the science is just starting to catch up to what people have intuitively believed for a very, very long time. Things like the dog understands me. The dog is feeling empathy towards me. The dog loves me. The dog is sad right now. These are such easy statements to make, and it's surprising when you get into the literature to find out how little backing for them there is. But that has been changing in the past 30 years or so as it's become more respectable for scientists to start doing experiments to find, you know, can we prove that a dog is feeling? And I looked at all kinds of strange experiments, and not just ones with so-called higher animals, but things like pigeons being taught to tell the difference between abstract and impressionist paintings, or cockroaches, of all things, being trained to tell a familiar person from a new person. So I think as this research comes out and people become more aware of it, it's going to shift the debate on what is and isn't acceptable to do to an animal.
Wow. Watch this space. Feel the love. James Vlahos' piece in the New York Times Magazine, Pill Popping Pets. James, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Stephanie Lafarge is Senior Director of Counseling Services for the ASPCA. Stephanie, thanks for your insights today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And Joel Gabriel Gold, psychologist in New York. It sounds like dogs will stay part of your practice, Dr. Gold.
Oh, very definitely. Very definitely. I just want to say one thing about emotions, that Darwin, back in 1845, wrote a book on...
He said they've got them. We're out of time. I'm sorry for that. Thanks very much for joining us, Dr. Gold. This is On Point.